I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Ahead this evening, applications for concealed carry permits spike in Bucks County after the Paris attacks. First, let's look back on a frantic morning in Center City, Philadelphia, after a traffic stop on I-676 turned into a fiery crash and shootout, with one state trooper wounded, two suspects in custody, two more still on the loose. It all started around 9:30 when State Trooper Patrick Casey pulled over a car going west on I-76 for having an expired registration. The driver and three passengers were removed from the car. Then an unnamed suspect got back in his car and fled, but immediately crashed into a school bus. Both vehicles burst into flames. Fortunately, no children were on board that bus. That's where State Police Captain James Rakovitz picks things up.
After the suspect vehicle hit the school bus, the suspect got out of the car and continued to fire at Trooper Casey, at which time Trooper Casey returned fire from inside his car and exited his car and got around to better cover for his protection. He realized he was hit at that time.
Casey was struck in the shoulder during the incident. He's reportedly in stable condition at Hahnemann University Hospital, and he's expected to remain overnight and make a full recovery. Meanwhile, two suspects were taken into custody, while two others fled before the crash. They're still at large. Philadelphia Mayor Michael Nutter paid Trooper Casey a visit in the hospital.
He asked me how I was doing. I said, well, that's really not the question right now. The question is, how are you doing?
All affected roadways reopened by around 2 this afternoon after being closed for several hours. Be careful what you tweet, because it could be used against you in a criminal trial. That was one of the lessons of a court hearing today in the case involving the violent beating of a gay couple in Center City last September. WHYY's Bobby Allen reports.
Two of the three alleged perpetrators in the assault of a gay couple near Rittenhouse Square have taken plea deals. But the third, Catherine Knott, the daughter of a police officer, has rejected a deal. She's now fighting her charges. The hearing weeks ahead of the start of her trial turned into a fight over tweets. A key question was, which tweets underscore Knott's character traits and which ones are irrelevant? State prosecutors said dozens of tweets Knott made years before the attack established that she has an anti-gay bias.
We never asked to admit evidence that we don't think is relevant and admissible. This is the type of thing that's discretionary. It's up to the court whether to let it in or not. I respect the court's discretion. You know, not everything is black and white. This was somewhere in the middle.
That's Assistant District Attorney Mike Berry. He pushed for several sets of tweets to be admitted as evidence. But defense attorney Lou Basico said it's really just an effort to smear his client.
Is there anybody out there who could dissect each and every one of their postings and tweets from 4 to 5 to 6 years ago and be able to explain it?
There were tweets showcasing excessive drinking, tweets showing possible racial prejudices, and tweets that, according to prosecutors, demonstrate that Knott harbored anti-gay feelings before the alleged beating. In the end, the judge said any tweets that could imply gay discrimination should be admitted. That's relevant. But the rest? The judge said too far removed from the allegations in the case. One of the tweets now a part of the official court record? In 2010, Knott tweeted that, quote, "Jazz flute is for little fairy boys." It's a line from the movie Anchorman, and now official evidence against Knott. She will stand trial next month against 2 counts of aggravated assault and other charges. For WHYY News, I'm Bobby Allen.
The longer the Pennsylvania budget stalemate continues, the more wreckage it leaves in its wake. Social service agencies are now worrying about shutting down. School districts are borrowing huge sums of money. One group that's feeling the uncertainty is in-state college students. State financial aid grants cannot be distributed until Harrisburg reaches a resolution. More from Keystone Crossroads' Eleanor Klibanoff.
A few weeks ago, Penn State sent an email to 15,000 students, including Sarah Kagaris, a sophomore.
I actually got an email from the bursar saying, like, hey, there's an outstanding charge on your bursar's account. You need to pay this.
Kagaris' account said she owed $1,700, and she wouldn't be able to get her grades or register for classes until it was paid. Kagaris did what most 20-year-olds would do when confronted with a bill for nearly $2,000.
I freaked out.
The Office of Financial Aid at Penn State has been dealing with these freakouts all semester. When you call their office, before you even speak to a representative, there's a recording that cuts to the chase.
Please note, if you are calling about the disbursement of your Pennsylvania state grant, the grant will not be disbursed until the Pennsylvania state budget has been passed.
Each year, a portion of the state budget goes towards need-based financial aid for Pennsylvania college students. This year, the Pennsylvania Higher Education Assistance Agency was expecting to give over 153,000 students a total of $420 million in grants. But that money isn't there, according to Keith New of FIA.
We can't disperse any funds until we receive the funds from the General Assembly. So the schools have an idea of what they can expect when the funds arrive, but each school has to decide how they're going to handle that based on their own resources.
Penn State students across all Commonwealth campuses were expecting $26 million in Pennsylvania state grants. Almost 15,000 students got emails telling them that they owed money to the school. Anna Griswold, executive director of student aid, says those emails went out automatically, but students are not expected to front the money.
Because it's taken so long, we're proceeding to just put temporary money in place for students so that their accounts do not show that they have this outstanding balance pending their grant.
The Office of Financial Aid has scrambled to cancel automation, reprogram their system to accept these temporary funds, and prepare for a system reversal once the funds do arrive. Griswold says Penn State, like many schools in Pennsylvania, has found the funds to cover the deficit temporarily.
The university will be short somewhere. It's just a tough choice. What else can we delay or postpone in order to make this support available to students and with high hopes that it's on a temporary basis?
The nature of Pennsylvania state grants makes the delay more complicated. The grant goes towards tuition, unless a student has their tuition fully covered. Then they can use the grant for other educational expenses, off-campus housing or books, for example. The maximum Pennsylvania state grant amount is about $4,300 per student. That's a small percentage of the cost of a college education. But FIA's Keith New says for many students, the holdup is no small matter.
I mean, these state grant awards are critically important because these dollars go to the students who need them the most.
Like Sarah Kagaris, her parents might have been able to swing the $1,700 if necessary, but she's a triplet. All three of them are in-state students getting these state grants. Kagera says this experience has made her wary. She and her roommate plan to use their Pennsylvania state grants to pay for an off-campus apartment next year.
Okay, so we have a little less than a year to save enough money to make sure we can at least pay like maybe 2 months' rent without a refund in case like there's another budget impasse again.
So, lawmakers in Harrisburg, rest easy. If nothing else comes out of this budget impasse, at least you've taught a Penn State sophomore the value of an emergency fund. Eleanor Klibanoff, Keystone Crossroads.
When events in the news make you feel unsafe, you might be tempted to change your behavior. WHYY's Laura Benchoff reports that that's the case for some in Bucks County, where applications to carry a concealed weapon spiked after terrorist attacks in Paris.
Bucks County Sheriff Duke Donnelly says he's seen this kind of response before.
The last time we had a kick like this was when they had the shooting up in Connecticut, that school shooting.
That was in 2012. Donnelly says the current upswing translates into about 20 new applications a day and will probably die down in a couple weeks. Daniel Webster, director of the Center for Gun Policy and Research at Johns Hopkins University, says mass shootings lead to what-if thinking that makes some people more interested in carrying a firearm.
If only the victims had been armed, some people argue, they would have been able to reduce the casualties, if nothing else.
But Webster says there's no credible evidence that more people legally carrying guns reduces crime rates. Even without high-profile shootings, some area counties report a long-term increase in concealed carry applications. Montgomery County Sheriff Russell Bono says his county only tracks the permits by month, so there's no data from directly after the Paris attacks. But he says the last 5 years have seen a steady growth in new permits.
In September, there were 284 new applicants. In October, there were 452. So, I mean, if you can tell me what happened between September and October, there may be some correlation, but we don't track it that way.
Pennsylvania's application doesn't ask people why they want to carry a gun. For WHYY, I'm Laura Benshoff.
Taking a look at this evening's headlines, Pennsylvania Senate Republicans say they may try to override Governor Tom Wolf's veto of a short-term spending bill after budget talks hit yet another wall. Republican senators said the chamber was being called back into session tonight for a possible vote. A successful override requires the cooperation of at least three Democrats, assuming all 31 Republican senators support it. A Republican lawmaker wants a Pennsylvania House committee to investigate whether State Attorney General Kathleen Kane should be removed from office. Representative Garth Everett said about a dozen colleagues signed on today after he circulated a memo regarding a resolution to undertake a Judiciary Committee investigation of Kane. A Syrian family is preparing to be resettled in New Jersey, 1 week after Governor Chris Christie told President Barack Obama that the state would not accept any more Syrian refugees. The Record of Bergen County reports that an interfaith group is preparing an apartment in Patterson for a family of seven set to arrive next week. Clear skies, 44 degrees at 6:17. You're listening to Newsworks Tonight on WHYY. Falling back to 33 degrees overnight. Sunny tomorrow, Wednesday's high 52. For Thanksgiving Day, a mix of sun and clouds, high 60 degrees. And Friday, partly sunny, high 62. Still ahead.
Landscape for Temple, I think, was not always a high priority.
But that may be changing as Temple University plans a stadium and more green spaces. Details when Newsworks Tonight continues on WHYY.
New Jersey's Clean Energy Program proudly supports WHYY. New Jersey's Clean Energy Program, incentivizing businesses, local governments, schools, and residents to integrate energy-efficient and renewable technologies into their new construction projects, existing building upgrades, and new equipment installation. More information about modernizing in your home and business with support from New Jersey's Clean Energy Program at njcleanenergy.com/WHYY.
This fall, only at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, Audubon to Warhol, The Art of American Still Life, revealing the simple beauty and meaning of everyday things. It makes the familiar fresh and enables us to see things in new and different ways, with masterpieces by such celebrated artists as Charles Wilson Peale, John James Audubon, Georgia O'Keeffe, and Andy Warhol. This is one of the largest exhibitions of American still life in over 30 years. Tickets at philamuseum.org. The Philadelphia Museum of Art supports WHYY.
Welcome back to Newsworks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. Temple University continues its ambitious plans to transform its campus space, and the predominant hue will be decidedly green. Let's travel north on Broad Street with Margaret Carney, Temple University Associate Vice President and University Architect. Margaret, thanks for joining us on Newsworks Tonight.
Thank you, Dave. It's great to be here.
So this is part of a much broader 2020 plan, I understand, but this specific part is called Verdant Temple.
Yes, that's correct.
Temple continues to shed its image as a commuter campus, but the intent of this in part will be to continue to make it much more of a residential community.
Absolutely, that's true. Yeah, so the master plan and the landscape master plan that we currently are working on an implementation of has really been one that has focused on the student experience, of course, but mostly it has said, we've said to ourselves that we really need to see the context of the city around us and make sure that the campus for a pedestrian in particular is really a place that is inviting, that feels safe, and that is memorable.
And you've described a campus's landscape as its brand, so to speak.
Yes, that's true. Landscape for Temple, I think, was not always a high priority. Let's say it was and actually a lot of cities in the past haven't really focused on landscape either so much as we do now. And I think between sustainability issues, environmental issues that we really are all paying attention to, landscape has really risen to the top as a place where a city can have impact and definitely where a campus can have impact.
Talk first about then the quad that's being proposed.
Yeah, the quad. We never have had that kind of a space. The campus has grown up over time occupying with individual buildings, occupying city blocks as they became available. And so the concept of the campus, which many universities have from their inception, was never really one that Temple had. But the green space really became an opportunity when we finished the 2020 plan and the library, which on the first plan was going to be built on Broad Street, the library was just getting started. Our new president arrived and said, the library should really be the piece that anchors the campus as an academic place. So we decided to take a look at what would happen if we brought the library into the interior of the campus. And without any open space, we really needed to create an open space that would give the library prominence as a center to the campus. The financing for a space like this big quad is something that we really actually are still putting together.
What are relations between community and campus? How would you assess it?
I would say it's mixed. I think from my perspective, from where I sit, I get a lot of time with community groups to talk about what we're doing and to listen to their thoughts about that, their reactions to it, their ideas about what we haven't done that we ought to be looking at. Those are the conversations where I think we're learning a lot about how we should be thinking about certainly landscape, definitely buildings, and also about things that really are not so much about space but are influenced by space. So what I mean is student behavior and the way we communicate with the neighbors. So, you know, there's a lot of discussion now about the idea of a potential stadium on the campus, and that will certainly bring a lot of discussion, a lot of meetings where people are coming together. And from my point of view, that could only be good.
You came to Philadelphia and Temple from Cleveland, Case Western Reserve. Were you able to bring along any of the ideas that bore fruit there, and would they succeed at Temple as well?
I think not really in terms of physical design of the landscape, because in some ways they were very different places. The landscape in University Circle, where Case Western Reserve exists, is actually quite an old and beautiful landscape in and of itself. By being in that environment, I saw how much the landscape influenced people's sense of belonging, people's sense that they wanted to be outside and really observe the buildings, really feel the vibe of the city that surrounded us. And so here, when I came and saw how little beautiful green space there was, I felt like we could get closer to what we had in Cleveland and find ways to make that happen.
Now, if only Cleveland's basketball team could impart wisdom on our 76ers. Margaret Carney, thanks so much for joining us on Newsworks Tonight.
You're welcome.
Margaret Carney, Temple University Associate Vice President and University Architect. The history of recorded music finds a home in an unlikely place, a former bank building in Berlin, New Jersey. From WHYY's Arts and Culture Desk, Peter Kermans reports that the vault is a museum and performance venue devoted to the secret history of the Victor Talking Machine Company.
A few years ago, a musician named Graham Alexander bought the Victor Talking Machine Company in order to bring the region's musical legacy back to life.
Whenever I was a little kid, I used to walk down, you'd be near Camden, being with my mom, and I used to point to these dead factories, you know, and she'd say, well, that was RCA, and before that it was Victor, and it's, what does that mean?
Victor was the company that invented the record in Camden in 1901. Before that, most recordings were made on Thomas Edison's wax cylinders. Victor, and later RCA, were headquartered in a sprawling campus along the Camden waterfront, where artists from around the world flocked to be recorded. Graham Alexander made his nut on Broadway, performing in two musicals based on the Beatles. He played Paul. That allowed him and a group of partners to buy the Victor Talking Machine Company, Victrola, and his master's voice. Those companies are just empty names. They have no assets. But as the Victor Talking Machine Company, Alexander is scooping up all the records from the Victor label that he can still find. And that's not easy, because in 1962, its parent company, RCA, decided that the entire Victor catalog was not worth storing. So it literally blew up the warehouse where 300,000 records were stored and bulldozed the whole thing into the Delaware River and built a shipping dock on top of it.
They deemed that every recording Victor Records made from about 1900 to 1945, for the most part, was worth no more than the fill of a cement dock.
Before destroying a half century of music, RCA allowed its employees to grab what they wanted, and this is one that was saved. This is a master recording cut into metal of a jazz band. There's a matrix number etched into the disc, but Alexander says there is no corresponding record of that number.
I mean, there must be an aficionado that knows who that is. I mean, the playing style is pretty distinct, and it's very good. Do you know what I mean? It's definitely some top human beings.
Alexander has about 10,000 discs like this. Only about 1,000 are cataloged. He plans to release them as streaming digital files. He also wants to sign new bands to the company and make and release new records. This all happens at The Vault, a former bank building Alexander has transformed into a small museum and performance space.
To be able to bring people into a museum is one thing, because we give tours. Ultimately, by having a little performing arts stage in there, it brings it back down to what matters about the recording industry, which is humans performing music.
The performance lineup at The Vault is just getting started and still finding its feet. So far, it's mostly Graham Alexander himself performing on stage. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
Finally this evening, for many, a Thanksgiving without turkey is just plain wrong. To others, like the Ethical Humanist Society of Philadelphia, it's only right. On Thanksgiving from noon to 3, the Ethical Society will host a Gentle Vegan Thanksgiving Day Community Potluck. It's a mouthful in more ways than one. The event takes place at the Society's headquarters in Rittenhouse Square. It promises to be more than the breaking of bread and tofu with perfect strangers. Event organizers say the dinner will center on stimulating discussion, music, and speeches by local vegan advocates. So, if you're looking for a more enlightening Thanksgiving experience than hearing your brother-in-law complain about the Eagles, this just might be the Gentle Vegan Community Potluck for you. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov and Kimberly Haas. Find us on iTunes or check us out at newsworks.org. A small music studio in Philadelphia is helping to make big dreams come true on the cheap with a side of goodwill. We'll have that story on tomorrow's show. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.
Do you know someone with mild to moderate Alzheimer's? A clinical trial is being conducted to evaluate the safety and effectiveness of a study drug for the treatment of symptoms of Alzheimer's disease. Qualified participants must be at least 50 years old and have a support person to attend study visits. Qualified participants receive study-related medical care, memory testing, and routine lab work. Details at 215-884-1700. 215-884-1700. The Clinical Trial Center supports WHYY.
On the next Fresh Air, how ISIS is trying to acquire a lethal substance called red mercury to weaponize into a doomsday bomb. But red mercury doesn't exist. We'll talk with New York Times reporter C.J. Chivers about his article, The Doomsday Scam. And we'll talk about the weapons ISIS has managed to get its hands on and how it got them. Join us.
Tonight at 7 on WHYY-FM.
Virtua proudly supports WHYY. This is the time of year to sign up for health insurance. When choosing a health insurance plan, it's important to know whether your doctor or hospital is included. If you want to use a Virtua physician, hospital, or outpatient service, you can find out if Virtua is in the plan you're considering by calling 888-VIRTUA-3. That's 888-VIRTUA-3. Virtua proudly supports WHYY.